This is WPM, Writing, Publishing, and Marketing, and it's brought to you by Mott Publishing and by WSCA Community Radio. And we do this the second Tuesday of every month. This is the fifth event in the series. We've had a long list of outstanding authors who've done this, and we have some great authors tonight. I'll give you a little history of the event. My wife and I have Mott Publishing, and we've been publishing books for about 5 years, and we've been involved in many book events all around the seacoast. And we thought that what was needed was something that covered the whole spectrum of the writing experience, from getting the idea of a book, through writing the book, getting it published, and then the hard part, marketing it. And so Marilyn came up with this WPM, which she used to be a typist, and so we're in a minute. tonight we have James Patrick Kelly talking about writing. We have Jeff Deck talking about publishing, and we have Dan Zesny talking about marketing. And so I'll turn it over to Jim Kelly.
All right, so I'm not going to give a long introduction about myself. I'm a science fiction writer. I've been writing science fiction for about 40 years. I've published a ton of stuff. And last night, I gave a webinar for the New Hampshire Writers Project. I gave an hour-long talk about the Hooking Your Readers, it was called, the critical first 250 words. And so I talked for an hour about this, and I'm going to try to boil this down into 10 minutes. And so in order to do that, to help me get through it, I have a handout. And so if you'd like one, you're welcome to have one.
I'd love one.
And there's some here for you. So why is it important that you concentrate on the first 250 words of your whatever, your novel, your story? Well, okay, so it's because of the art of it. The craft should be right. And here's the real reason, though, is that if you are submitting a story or a novel to an editor, that editor has been carefully trained to know as soon as possible when he should stop paying attention. And so he will be looking at your first 250 words to see if you actually know what you're doing. And there are certain tells that he will know in the second sentence, in the third paragraph, that says, I don't need to read anymore, I'm not buying this story, done. If you get by the first 250 words, unfortunately the case is that the editor will probably then read the last page to see if you took off fine, but could you land the plane? And only then will they go back and actually try to read the middle, and they'll stop reading when you make that mistake. Because here's the thing, I told this story last night. I had a friend who was a slush reader for Asimov Science Fiction magazine, and the editor said, look, you want to make a little extra money, Greg? I'll tell you what, I'll give you $50, and I'll give you a box of manuscripts, and you go through it, pass anything along you think is worth passing along, and then I'll give you $50. So he would sit there and watch TV, sitcoms or the football, something. He'd pick a manuscript out, look at the first page, boom, boom, boom. He'd do a box in an hour. And that's about, and he passed on maybe three or four or five out of that box. So here's the thing I'm going to do. I don't know if I'll get through this or not, but I came at this topic from a couple different directions. So those first 250 words, if you imagine what your first 250 words look like, that's maybe the first, it depends on where you start on your first page. But it's your first page and maybe some fraction of the second page. So think about your own story. And then think about, do those first 250 words answer the five questions that an editor is thinking about? So here they are. These are pretty obvious. What is the story about? And like lots of times, people will start with a lyrical passage about the lilies nodding in the field, or a cyberpunky noir thing about, you know, people driving down dirty streets, or a romantic description of a restaurant where two lovers are about to show up. If that's what you spent your first 250 words on, the reader and the editor doesn't know what the story is about. Why are they doing what they're doing? Well, wait a minute, that sort of presupposes that there's someone in the first 250 words. Lots of times you forget, not everyone, but people who are aspiring writers forget to put a person in the first 250 words. What is the story about? Oh, I'm sorry. I should have said, who is the story about? That is the first one, because that's the obvious one. There should be a character, your protagonist, in the first 250 words. What is the story about? So then you're trying to figure out, well, okay, is our guy in the field smelling the lilies? Why is he in the field? We don't know if he doesn't leave the lily field in that first 250 words. Where does the story take place? Okay, at least we know it's in a lily field, but wait a minute. Is it in a lily field in France? Is it in a lily field on another planet? And when does the story take place? These are basic questions, and you got 250 words to sort of, you don't have to have exact answers, but at the end of 250 words, a careful reader, a professional reader, an editor, should have an idea that you know the answer to those questions. Okay, so those are sort of basic. So what are the goals of those first 250 words? To me, one of the most important things of the opening of a story is it teaches the reader how to read it. So this goes to many different parts of the story, but for one thing, it goes to genre. If you're writing a romance, then you have to sort of tip the reader that this is a romance kind of story. If you're writing a science fiction story, you need to drop a science fiction clue in those first 250 words. If you're going to write a story about revenge, then you probably want to have some sort of understanding that revenge is going to fit into this story. So you sort of make a contract, you make a promise to the reader in those first 250 words. Because moving away from the editor, I'm here to tell you, I'm a longtime science fiction writer. I have a lot of friends who write science fiction. I look at maybe 3 or 4 magazines every month. I don't read every story. And why don't I read every story? Because I look at the promise that the story is making and I say, I don't care. I mean, I'm sure it's well written. I'm sure other people are going to like it. For me, no. Okay. You want to foster a sense of immediacy. So you want the reader to be thrust into the hurly-burly of what's happening in the story. You want specific details. You want to say that the group was gathered in a brick building on a sort of back crummy lot parking lot. It's sort of away from the street in a very Tony town. What was it doing back here? It's a little shabby, but on the other hand, it's brightly lit. They've spent a lot of time with colored lights, which are flashing on. See, these are specific things that you're describing that set the scene for where you are. Establish your story's credibility. If you're writing historical, you can't have anachronisms. If you're writing a story about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you have to know something about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. You have to sort of know maybe what kind of car he drove around in. You have to know what was the kind of cigarette he smoked. Everyone has this picture of him with the
filter.
Whatever that thing is called. Yeah. But there was a cigarette in the end of that. Even if it's right, he had his Pall Malls in the cigarette. That is a specific thing that makes people say, yes, that world is really, that person knows what he's doing. He's got credibility with me. And the last thing is narrative momentum. So you want something to happen in the first 250 words that's going to thrust the reader into the rest of the story. Okay, so here then is the last part, is the 10 recommendations. I call them the 10 commandments. So some of these you absolutely have to do. Some of these you should strive to do. And some of them, if you don't do them in the first 250 words, they should show up in the first 500 words. So, first of all, lock in your point of view. You guys know what point of view is: first person, second person, third person. If you're in a wandering point of view, if you're trying for omniscient point of view, this is in some ways, especially if you're an aspiring writer, you haven't got yet the command of your craft, that will tip an editor off right away that your wobbly point of view means that you don't know what you're doing. It's a very difficult thing to put off omniscient point of view, where I'm in your head, I'm in my head, and I'm in his head. And sometimes you do that because something really interesting happens in another room that your protagonist, your point of view character, isn't there, and someone else is there, and you want that to get into the story, so you pop into that person's point of view just so he can witness the murder, and then come back into the detective's point of view, and all of a sudden, no, that's Bush. Introduce a protagonist. Like I said, who's the story about? First 250 words, probably in the first paragraph, hopefully in the first sentence. Establish the setting, okay? Where, specifically? Think about your genre. Think about your reader, where he wants to be if he's going to be reading your story. create a tone. This is kind of a weird thing, but if you're writing a funny story, there should be a joke in the first 250 words. If you're writing a horror story, there should be a feeling of dread, a tone of dread in that first 250 words. Don't start with the lily field if there's a zombie. You know, even if you want to shock the reader, there's a zombie hiding in the lily field. There has to be some sort of like subtext of dread in there. And so establish a tone. Write a hook for a sentence. Everyone says this. You don't have to do it, but it's really good if you can. If you can do that, you're already ahead of the game. You're probably sailing along. But there's many, many, many wonderful stories that don't have a hook for a sentence. That goes into the maybe you should try that. Start in the middle. This is a weird thing because I'm also going to say show the status quo. But if somebody is going to do a cask of Amontillado, the thousand injuries of Fortunato I had borne as best I could, but when he ventured upon insult, I vowed revenge, from Edgar Allan Poe. In that first sentence, you're starting in the middle because something happened that Fortunato insulted the narrator. But that's not important. Almost it's beside the point whatever he said, because the narrator has decided to take revenge on him for whatever he said. You're starting in the middle. But the other thing here is that also sort of points to, even though it's not in the story yet, it sort of points to the status quo. What happened before the story started? You want to, if you don't actually show it, you want to intimate that that's what was going on before the precipitating event, which is the thing that starts the plot. So the precipitating event means maybe Fortunato's insult was the insult, or maybe it was our narrator's decision of how to get his revenge, and so whatever unfolds from that. And so, and start with action and dialogue. How much time do I have left? Can I have a little bit?
2 minutes.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so now you will notice that says that's a checklist. And now, folks, you can play at home. I'm going to read you the opening of a story, and as I go through, think about, and you can actually mark it on your checklist if you want, how many of these points have I actually hit? This is my new novel, not the one that's just been published, but a new one. Oh, and I'll start by saying, it is set on a world very much like ours, except day after tomorrow, aliens come and disappear all the men. Okay. I was pedaling toward lunch when my sidekick chirped. I pulled up and straddled the bike with one foot on the curb. There was no visual on the little screen, but some granny with a raspy voice announced that she was Maud Descano and needed to see me right away. I probably shouldn't have laughed. The only Maud Descano I'd ever heard of was so connected downtown that the city mothers took turns mowing her lawn. I do my best for my clients, but I'm a realist. Why would the Maud Descano be calling a private detective when she had Deputy Chief Little singing harmony for her? It was a question worth asking. So I did. Whoever this granny was, she decided to get huffy. I don't discuss my affairs over the phone, she said. She would have to have been a fossil if she remembered phones. Their time was all over before the devils disappeared all the men. Fair enough, I said. I'm just on my way to lunch, so maybe we can get together this afternoon, say 2 o'clock. Where can we meet?
Make it now or don't bother, Miss Hardaway. 122 Fairview.
My play then should have been to tell her to get cocked and cut the connection, except that Fairview ran through a neighborhood where even the sewers were lined with gold. Given her manners and that address, maybe she was the Maud Descano. If for no other reason than I might get to swipe an ashtray or spill something sticky on her sofa, I decided not to bite back. Do you hear someone knocking on your front door? I said. That's me. Open up. Okay, quickly. What's the story about? P.I. What are they doing? Why is he doing what they're doing? Well, everyone's a she here, is looking for work. Who is the story about? Oh, it's about Faye Hardaway, our P.I. What is the story about? Why are they doing what they're doing? She's trying to get work. Where does the story take place? It takes place in some city. There's cars, there's... when does the story take place? You can't really tell here, except it is sort of has a contemporary feel. Did I teach the reader how to read your story? Well, I don't know. You'll have to be the judge of that. Foster a sense of immediacy? Yeah, I think so. You're there with her. She's on the bike. She's got her foot on a curb. She's talking on a phone. Establish your story's credibility? You'd be the judge. That narrative momentum? Yeah, because the case is just starting. So, did I lock in point of view? Yep, first person. Did I introduce the protagonist? Yep. Did I establish a setting? Yep. Create a tone? That's what I'm most proud of there. It's that sort of wisecracking noir tone. Write a hook first sentence? No, not really. I was pedaling toward lunch when my sidekick chirped. Not very hooky. Start in the middle? Oh, yeah. Include action and dialogue? Done. Introduce other characters? Done. Show the status quo? I don't know, except that she's looking for work. So that's the status quo, whatever she was doing before she was got this phone call. And prepare for the precipitating event? Sure, when she goes down and find out what the job is, the story will start.
Thank you, Jim. Well done. Contracted an hour into 10 minutes. I'm going to ask everybody to hold their questions until the end so we can get the three presentations done. So now I'm just going to turn it over to Jeff Deck, who will tell you all about himself.
All right, so of the WPM, we just heard W. I am P. And Jim Kelly is, as always, a hard act to follow. I'm really excited to be here with Jim and with Dan. I've read both of their work, and it's awesome, and they're both stand-up dudes, so this is really a privilege to be here tonight. My name is Jeff Deck, and I'm an author, of course. I'm also a fiction ghostwriter and editor, and I know I'm going to forget it later, so I'm just going to say jeffdeck.com. Easy to remember. So I wanted to talk a little bit about traditional publishing versus self-publishing, since I've had some experience with both, and it's a very different experience. My traditionally published book was a book called The Great Typo Hunt, about a journey around the country to fix typos and signage, and so that was published by Random House, which is now Penguin Random House. Also known as the Big Five. The Big Five refers to the five major publishing houses in New York that all have various subdivisions and imprints that they publish through. They have a very big share of the market. So publishing with Random House gave me an insight into the Big Five experience. And I've also self-published my book, The Pseudo Chronicles of Mark Huntley, is a supernatural thriller that I used Amazon to self-publish. I used their printing arm called CreateSpace to print copies of the book, and used both Amazon and Nook as ebook platforms to distribute it that way. So. I guess what I want to say, just as a word of warning, is that it's a long road either way, whether you go through traditional publishing or self-publishing. The thing that differs is the placement of that long road. In traditional publishing, it's going to be a long road, at least for the Big Five, before you get published, because of the double layers of gatekeepers that you have to pass through in order to get your book on the market. First layer being agents, and then the second layer being editors. On the other hand, with self-publishing, the long road happens basically after you publish, because people need to find your books, and no one knows who you are in most cases. And I want to mention, too, that, of course, there's a third option, going with small press publishing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is probably going to be a shorter road before you get publishing, before you get published, because in a lot of cases, you're not going to need an agent as an intermediary to deal with a small publisher. But the drawback there is that it might turn out that nobody knows who you are, and nobody knows who they are either, and they might not have the major bookstore distribution that the Big Five does. The major publishers already have deals in place with the national bookstore chains and with some of the big indies around the country to distribute books. So that's kind of one of the built-in advantages of traditional publishing. If you can, get past those gatekeepers, the distribution is a lot better. For self-publishing, let's say for my Mark Huntley book, I would have to, if I wanted to get my book into, let's say Barnes & Noble, it would be kind of a difficult process, in part because bookstores are used to being able to easily return books. The deal that they have with major publishers is that if books don't seem to be selling very quickly, that they can return them to the publisher for no extra cost, putting a lot of the risk back on the publisher. And so if they're not able to have that kind of arrangement with you and with your books, they're going to be much less likely to take the risk. You can get, some of the smaller stores, let's say right here in Portsmouth, like River Run, mm-hmm. to take your books if you kind of sign something with them that is, a consignment agreement, where basically if the books aren't selling, then, they can give them back to you. They don't have to pay anything to you up front. And then if the book sells, usually consignment agreements are, like 70-30 or 60-40. You get 60 or 70% of the sale, they get 30 or 40%. So there's ways to get into those markets. You also have to figure, though, let's say you do get a book into River Run, it's also surrounded by, a lot of other books, probably most of which are more well-known. So if you can get some sort of good table placement, that's going to help people find your book, a lot more readily. When it starts to kind of retreat into the section of whatever genre it belongs to, then it's going to be a lot harder for people to find it. So it's, there's trade-offs here, but I guess I just want to talk about the self-publishing route a little bit more, because, traditional publishing, there's a lot of advice out there. Self-publishing, there is also a lot of advice out there. I feel like some of it you have to be cautious about, because it might just be someone trying to sell you their course or their book about how to self-publish that they self-published. So it's, I just want to talk about some of the experiences that I've had with self-publishing. And the first would be that if you're considering it, you've probably been wondering, well, what about this, stigma that seems to exist for books that are self-published? You might have, heard some of that, particularly from your author friends. It's been my experience that kind of disdain for self-publishing and that stigma comes mostly from other authors. So, usually those who are, traditionally published or who are seeking traditional publishing. So, I find that it's not something that readers themselves care about as much as long as you have a professional presentation. I was just reading John Grisham's new book, Camino Island, which is about, it's like a mystery about writers. And, it was recommended to me by some family members. And actually, I came to a stop reading it when he kind of pulled down his pants and took a poop on the cell publishers. it's something the characters were saying, but it didn't seem to be something that the author was particularly disagreeing with. And you'll get that kind of reaction from like major traditionally published authors who have found like a path of success for themselves, and a lot of the lobbying groups like the ABA and the Authors Guild, they're going to be more biased towards traditional publishing. But when it comes down to it, it's inside baseball. It's stuff that you don't really have to worry about if you want to reach readers directly and make sure that they're the ones that care about your books. The really important thing is to just make sure that in a couple of areas that you really can like stand up to the quality of, let's say, a Big Five published book. And so one of the most important things there is to get it professionally edited. You know, maybe your novel is structurally perfect already. Maybe you've, you know, line edited it until it shines, you know, and that's awesome. You know, even if it's that's the case, and even if you only need like a proofread, like that's still super important because, you know, there's going to be mistakes no matter how carefully, you know, you think that you're reading your own work, because you're never going to be able to catch all of your own mistakes. So it's really important to, you know, have someone else take a look at it, preferably a professional editor. If, you know, if you can't afford that, find some good beta readers who you trust and, you know, who are the kind of people who might say be fans of the book, The Great Typo Hunt. you want people who are going to catch all of your, you know, things that are otherwise going to be like going out in public, you know, with your fly unzipped. And, you know, I've read self-published books where clearly they didn't take that step. You know, it does happen. And I think if someone, you know, reads a book like that, that might be where they get the idea that, you know, self-publishing is not professional. But, you know, publishing a book is as professional as you make it. The other big thing besides professional editing is professional cover design. The goal is to be able to have your book sit on a shelf beside a book that's been published by a Big Five publisher and have, you know, someone who's casually browsing not be able to tell the difference. When I self-published Mark Huntley, I paid a pretty decent amount of money for professional cover design and interior design as well. And I wanted to mention also that that is just as important. I mean, the first impression of the cover is, of course, very important. You want it to look good, you know, have the type to be all set and looking professional, to have the design something that's eye-catching, to not use papyrus font. That's helpful. But once the reader opens the book, you want to also have interior formatting, you know, then, you know, help them confirm that, you know, buying this book is a good idea. I mean, I've opened up self-published books with, you know, beautiful covers to then find, let's say, paragraphs with, you know, full line space between them. You know, a paragraph, then a line space, then a paragraph, then a line space. No. Or enormous margins around the text. Or next to no margins.
Or no
margins.
Yeah, right.
You know, and these are all things that you don't have to be a professional formatter to, you know, be aware of. All you have to do, you know, if you can't remember what the usual formatting standards are, just, you know, pull some books that you enjoy off your shelf, you know, traditionally published books, and study them, and, you know, look for all those things that you're not going to be looking for as a reader, but, you know, are things that readers unconsciously are looking for signs of professionalism. I just want to wrap up with a note about this scary word platform, which is something that comes into play when making that decision of, you know, self-publishing versus traditional publishing. Self-publishing, you know, it really works best if you already have a platform. And what I mean by platform is you already have an audience of people who already know and love you and are very eager to you know, read what you're writing. You know, maybe it's a large social media following that you have. Maybe it's a large email subscriber list, or both. If you have a platform already, self-publishing is really the best way to go. Now, I would say that traditional publishing is the best way to go if you already have a platform. So the answer is platforms are important for both, especially for Big Five publishers. I guess it can sound you know, a little discouraging when I put it that way, but traditional publishers these days are most likely to accept your manuscript if you already have a platform of, you know, people paying attention to you, because they're going to save most of their marketing budget for the people who are already big names, because it's kind of a risk averse industry. You know, I mean, just like Hollywood, you know, it's the reason why we keep getting sequels and reboots. They want guaranteed success as much as they can, guarantee it. So if you come to them and you say, all right, I've already got a bunch of people, who are following what I write, who know who I am, it's going to be much more easy for them to, convince themselves to accept your manuscript. An example of this, when I landed the deal for the Great Typo Hunt book, I had already kind of self-generated a lot of publicity for my typo hunting trip. And so they already saw that I had had all these big, major media gets. And so they're like, okay, this is a pretty good investment for us. But you don't need to, go on the Today Show in order to have a platform. It helps to just find some way that you can kind of like dig in, and find your audience on, let's say, a specific, social media venue, or if you, know a lot about a certain topic and are passionate about it and can blog about it in a convincing way. I mean, this is kind of segueing into marketing, which is why, saved it for last year, but it's an important thing to keep in mind, even before your books are published. If you don't have a platform, it's time to start building one now, before your books are published. Because if you can build yourself up as a brand, then you're going to come into the game with a big advantage once it's time for your books to be published. So that's going to take us to Dan and to marketing with right. Steve first.
Thanks. Once again, I know that the listeners at home can't see the thousands of people out here who are sitting in the chairs waiting to ask questions, but we will ask you to hold your questions until the end. I know I'm going to have some questions. So let's turn it over to Dan Sesney.
Thanks, Steve. So thank you, Steve. Thanks, Marilyn. And thank you to Jim and Jeff, I will follow your compliments. We're two I've read both of their work, and I love both of their work. And I'm going to repeat and emphasize a few things that both Jim and Jeff said in this talk. So let's begin with a story. I'm a freelance writer. I've been a reporter for 20 years. I write memoirs. Yada yada yada. You can talk to me about it afterwards. just last week, I was actually on a trip up south in southern Ontario. We went up to Ottawa and South St. Marie and some areas up there. And there's a highway, Route 417, that connects South St. Marie to Ottawa. It's about 250 miles long. And we're driving from one city to the next. And as I was driving, I came across a series of billboards. There was probably, I counted five. There might have been more before I started counting them. Advertising an author and his books. Billboards. Advertising an author and his books. So talk about media, right? And the billboards were nicely done. I'm not going to name the author or the books. You can Google, Southern Ontario billboards, and it'll come up.
Wow.
But they were nicely done, and they were very simple. His website and just a quick line. Simple enough so that as I was driving, I didn't have to write it down. A few hours later, or a couple days later, I sat down because it interested me, and I knew this event was coming up, and I thought, oh, what an interesting way to market your books, right? So off I went, and I Googled his name, and I looked him up, and I found his website, and I went to Amazon, I went to Goodreads, and I saw all the reviews for his books. There was zero reviews for his... He had a lot of reviews, 50, 60, 70 reviews for a self-published book. That's a lot on Amazon. And there were zero reviews above 2 stars. And they all started with... This author should have spent more time on editing than on the billboards along the highway. So, what we have here is a case of marketing working on one end before the author had his product together on the other end.
Yeah.
So, where we're going to begin is where I'm going to start, and what I'm trying to say, and Jeff mentioned it a little bit, is that first... write your book, and then rewrite your book 3 or 4 times, and then find a beta reader, and then find a professional editor, and then find somebody to do your cover, and then figure out your typesetting, and make it look, be professional about it. Get all of those things lined up before you start looking for readers, because even if you have the most brilliant marketing strategy, like a billboard, it worked for me. It seemed to work. Everybody was talking about it. Even if your marketing strategy works, if your product does not work, it's going to work against you. Mm. So we'll start with that. Second, platform. Jeff talked a lot about platform. I'm going to talk to you about what worked for me. I can only tell you what's worked for me. I was a reporter and a journalist for 20 years before I started writing books. So I had already developed something of a readership and something of a following, and I love Facebook and I love social media and I like doing it. So it was easy for me to do it. But what I will tell you in this day and age, especially if you're just starting off, is if you are adverse to social media, if you don't know about this whole Twitter thing the kids are doing, or Facebook or your own website, suck it up and get it done, because that is 2017. This is not 1950 anymore, when Hemingway can get a Kirkus review and 10,000 people will buy his book. You need a platform. And Jeff is absolutely right. Start your platform now, before you're published. I use my Facebook page in between books. I use my Facebook page to give readers a little bit of taste of my writing. I write from the road. I write little snippets. I'm primarily a memoir writer. So it drives my wife crazy, but a lot of my writing has to do with where I am and what we're doing. And it allows people bridges in between my books that are coming out. So develop a following now, they're going to help you later. And develop a professional following. And by professional following, what I mean is that keep in mind that everything that you say or write or post on social media is there forever. Echo, 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 echo. you need to decide, where you want, you need to decide what type of a writer you want to be, what type of a platform you want to have, and what type of a readership you want to have, because what you say up there is going to stay there forever. So make that a point. Before coming here, I went, I'm not putting you guys on the spot. In fact, I'm really proud of the two of you. I went to Google, and I Googled Jeff Deck. Two names, Jeff Deck. This is what I'm going to need the numbers for. Jeff Deck came up with 21 million results. 21 million. But the top 9 of those 21 million were of that Jeff Deck. So... good job. Yeah. How many results do you think James Patrick Kelly came up with? 86 million. Because it takes James, it takes Patrick, yeah. It takes, so you can toss out a few hundred thousand of them, but still, 86 million, James. His website came first, his Wikipedia page came second. That is impressive stuff right there. That's how important that is. In case you're wondering, by the way, I came up 377,000 times. I have a very difficult last name.
So there's, and were you at the top?
And I was at the top as well. My website was at the top, so I went, whew!
Wow, cool.
So that's impressive and important stuff. And the reason that's impressive and important stuff is because your next step, you need to be able, what really worked for me is availability and being able to find me. When I wrote my first book, The Adventures of Buffalo. Let me actually back up for one sec and tell you something that didn't work for me, that I failed at early on in my marketing attempts. When my first book came out, Adventures of Buffalo and Tough Cookie, it was a small press, a small regional press. I was so excited about it. It was a short turnaround. The big presses are maybe a year and a half, 2 years, even longer. But regional presses are often 6 months, 8 months, 10 months. That's a pretty good turnaround for a small book. So when I got my first contract for my first book, the turnaround was about 6 months. It was going to be about 6 months before the book came out. So I had 6 months to build a social media following. So I went crazy. I built a Facebook page for the book. I built a website for the book. I had bookmarks of The Adventures of Buffalo and Tough Guy. I did all this stuff for the first book, and it worked. The book did pretty well for a small book. I sold a lot of copies. People seemed to enjoy it, and I had a following. And then my second book came along, and I had to trash all of that stuff, because I couldn't advertise my second book on my first book's Facebook page. So the mistake that I made was that I was building a brand based on my books as opposed to building a brand based on me, the writer.
Right.
So my advice is you are the creator, right? It's like you're Chrysler and you're building cars, right? So you're advertised Chrysler. don't advertise, or is Chrysler still in business?
Yes.
Was that a wrong example to use?
DeSoto, not DeSoto.
Right, yeah, no, right. you know, and to extend the metaphor, like Chrysler, you have good cars and bad cars, mostly bad cars. But the brand that you're building is you, is Jeff Deck and Jim Kelly. That's the brand. And, you know, in my case, I've written memoirs, I've written short fiction, I have a collection of short stories, I have a book of poetry. So it's really important to me that my readers follow me and not my books, right? That they follow me across genres, that they follow me across books. So you're building a brand. And part of the reason why you're building a brand is the final step that I wanted to mention that really worked for me, which was... you know, be professional. Mm. Be professional and be nice. Be professional and be nice. I mean, and I know these two guys personally, and even before I knew them close, when I just first met them, they were nice. They were nice guys, and they were helpful, and they were friendly, and they talked about writing. And the community in New Hampshire and in New England is so small. You know, as soon as you know, word gets round if you're not nice. So be nice. And I work part-time at a Auburn library. I call it my daycare job because it pays for my daughter's daycare. And so, you know, I worked in publishing for a long time at Hippo Press, so I'm very familiar with local and regional authors wanting reviews of their books or coming in to try to sell the library, you know, copies of their books, things like that. And that's really tricky business because you have one shot. And your shot isn't an email addressed to dear librarian, my book is great, can I buy it for your stats? Your shot is walking into the library in person, doing the footwork, figuring out who the director is, making sure the director is there, shaking that person's hand, and selling you, not your book. Hi, I'm a local author. I just published this book through CreateSpace or through, you know, Hobblebush Press or through wherever, or through Random House. It makes no difference. And I was wondering, I was hoping that maybe your library might be interested in buying the book for your stacks. And that's it. And make that personal contact and drop off a card. Have a business card with your email on it and your phone number on it. And don't hard sell. Walk out of there and follow up in a week. That's how you do it. Mm. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of work. When my book first came out, when my book was in the process, my first book was in the process of coming out, I literally got a map out. I live in Manchester. I literally got a map out, and I looked at Manchester land, which would be Goffstown, Auburn, Manchester, Londonderry, Derry, Amherst, Hooksett, Candia, Bow, and each of those libraries. And I did the footwork. I figured out who the librarian was. I figured out who the community relations person. Some of them have them, some of them don't. I figured out who does the events. Some of them have them, some of them don't. I wrote a little letter about the book. I combed my hair and brushed my teeth and put on some nice clothes. And I walked in there and I met each and every one of them.
Right.
And that relationship has lasted me throughout the course of all of my book writing. Now I can call the Derry Library and say, hey, I have a new book coming out in 6 months. Let's set up an event. And they say, yes. You know, so you got to do the work. And for those libraries that you can't reach up in Lancaster or Berlin or Gorham, there's nothing wrong with them. You got to go get them too. But if you can't reach them, I'm a notorious databaser. I love databasing. It's kind of a hobby, which is weird. So every state, New Hampshire has it, Vermont has it, Maine have it, every state, you can go to the state library system and you can get a list of every library and every bookstore in the state. You can get that list. It has the address on it. It has a phone number on it. Some of them have an email, and some of them even have the website. You download that list, and you just start making a database. Here's the library director. His or her name is this. This is his email. And you just start sending those emails out and make them all personal. Don't ever send an email to a library or to a bookstore. I doubt Michael Herman at Gibson's would pay you any attention if you wrote, "Dear bookstore owner."
Right.
So you got to do all that work. You got to put the footwork in. Because the end result is that you're selling yourself. You may have a lot of books out. I mean, heck, even Stephen King and Dan Brown sell themselves.
Right.
You know? It's about them. So sell yourself. That's all I have. Am I over or under?
No, you did well.
Okay,
you did
good.
Very well. You guys
there's lots more. I could talk about marketing firm.
Well, you're going to get a chance to talk some more because we're going to have questions from the audience, and you can address your question to one or all, and I'm going to ask each of the authors to pipe in on each question because what we found in doing this series is that we get a lot of different viewpoints and we get a lot of different bits of information from each of the authors. So, who's going to lead off here with a question? Yes?
Do you know about Lit Fire Publishing?
Lit Fire.
Room.
That is not one I'm familiar with.
I'm gonna repeat the questions just to make sure the microphone picks them up. The question is about Lit Fire. Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe that's it. Anyway, somebody told me about it. I called them, and they said, "Well, we'd love to see your manuscript." And then they started telling me and how much it was.
Right.
It
yeah. No.
$3,000.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a bit much.
It is.
There's a saying in science fiction land anyway, and that is money always flows to the writer.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in a situation where you're going to have to pay to get your stuff out there, that's a bad situation for you to have if you're going to make a career out of it. The only time I would ever pay is if I was entering a contest. And even that is kind of repugnant, but I get that sometimes that needs to happen. So, you know, somebody might charge you $10 or $15 to enter the best, you know, horse story of 2018 contest or whatever. But to pay someone to do that is, I think, a problematic to me anyway.
Yeah, they look like a self-publishing
story. The Writers Project charge for its literary contest.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. You know, it's because in some cases it's just what needs to happen. But you know,
so I need to jump in here in defense of self-publishers because we're not all bad guys. Many of them are. We went with a publisher who will remain nameless for our cookbook. We didn't know anything about writing books.
Yeah.
And Marilyn wrote a cookbook, and it's not just a cookbook. It has chapters about Chinese medicine and about alternative grains and all of that sort of thing. And I wrote 2 CDs of original music that come with the cookbook. So we had to find somebody who could print the book and put the CDs in there. And we went to a publisher, and they had a kind of a la carte service. You could pay for editing if you needed it. You could pay for layout if you needed it, and so on and so forth. Well, we didn't need editing. We just needed it to be laid out and printed, and that was it. And they charged us a sum of money for it, which I think is reasonable because they were providing services, and they were delivering a book to us. We knew how much each book was going to cost us. It seemed reasonable. We knew that we were making this investment and that we were paying them for services. I can tell you it was under $3,000, and we got a big box of books. We've talked to people who spent $9,000, $10,000,
$12,000
publishing
yeah.
their books and have sold 10, 10 books.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, which was back in the 19th century, they used to call them vanity presses.
Right.
And it was really looked down on in those days. If you published with a vanity press, nobody wanted anything to do with
it. Ex Libris, that was one of the first ones.
Yeah, Walt Whitman not only published his own book, but he set the type himself, and so there's a long tradition of this.
Yep.
But I think, especially for the people who are listening to this podcast, I think all of us would agree, be on the lookout. There are a lot of sharks out there that will charge you a huge sum of money to publish your book, give you a box of books, and just leave you on your own.
We charge you for our
services, and I think that's what a small self-publisher should do. We say that it'll probably cost you this much to get it edited because you've got proofreading and all that sort of thing. It'll cost approximately this much for me to lay it out and get all the type right, which like Jeff talked about and like Dan talked about, getting it to look good. Here's a cover artist that we used, and she charges X amount of money for it. And then it's up to you. If you want to do it, fine. If not, then you don't do it. But you really need to know what you're buying, who you're buying it for, from, and what happens after you pick up that box of
books. So what happens with your books? How do you get them into bookstores? I think that's the thing that is most problematic about self-publishing. You know, I don't mind paying for all the things that you said. You know, editing, cover art. I mean, I've self-published my own stuff. But then how does it get in front of readers? And so what you say is a lot of these places will give you a box of books and say, sayonara.
Yeah, see you later.
Or they'll sell you a PR pack, which is really nothing other than a list of the kind of list that Dan was talking about. Here are the local bookstores, and here are the publishers.
Go sell.
And they'll tell you that they'll get you on Ingram, and they'll get you on
Baker and
Taylor. And which, you know, the first one did. Well, that didn't do us any good, and we didn't sell any books because of that. Sure, it's in a database that every library and bookstore in the world sees, but that doesn't sell any books.
Right.
But what Jim is saying is absolutely right, and what Marilyn and I do is exactly what Dan does. We go out and beat the bushes and do events like this and sell books. So if you are going to go to a self-publishing company, be prepared for all of that. There is the middle ground that both Jeff and Dan talked about, which is regional publishers.
Yeah. Mm.
And I don't have any experience with them. The people I've talked to that have had experiences with them have had good experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying that the publisher Litfire was the one that sparked all of this. I'm not saying that they're necessarily bad. I'm just saying these are the things that I would watch out for if I went into a place like that. Actually, I think that was a very good question, and it obviously stirred a lot of emotion.
Yeah.
Anybody else have anything to...
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to mention on a related note, don't ever send your stuff to agents who charge to read your submissions. It's the same. This all ties into the same kind of predatory impulse, recognizing that there are a lot of eager authors out there, and they're going to try and, you know, take advantage of you from multiple angles. So you always have to vet whoever you're, submitting something to, or, you know, striking up a business deal with it. And for self-publishing, I mean, if you use something like, you know, Amazon's like CreateSpace, there's no like upfront charge. It's just, you know, the cost is just basically however, you know, it's a la carte based on how many copies you have printed. You know, I mean, so like there, and I'm sure there are other options like that where
Lulu?
You don't.
Lulu, is that one?
Yeah. Lulu.
There's a couple of them. Yeah,
Lightning Source.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to make a significant upfront investment.
I published through CreateSpace.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm also an artist, so I've illustrated and done the covers as well. I don't know whether they're, you know, as wonderful as they could be, but it's selling them that's the hard part.
Sure.
I mean, if I just pass them around to people I know, you know, and think, would you like this, you know, that sort of thing. That seems to go farther than anything else. I mean, I haven't been able to make contacts with libraries or anything like that.
Yeah. It's a lot of work. You have to track down. I know at my library, we actually have self-published books at my library. But what I will tell you is we don't have any self-published books that don't have an ISBN at my library, because the state system requires an ISBN in order to stock books at a library.
Mm.
There's a few exceptions to this with some community directors. I think Portsmouth might be an exception. There's a couple of other libraries that might be an exception. But it needs to be in a real book in order to do it. And you can't, if you send an email to... any library saying I'm a self-published author, they're not even going to return your email. But if you go in person and talk to the director,
I have.
Which director? Where have you gone?
Well, I don't know. I've been to Dover Public Library and Rollins Library.
Mm.
I said, don't you have an office day? You know, with the children. No, we don't. Can't do that.
Start at a smaller library.
Yeah.
Start. The Seacoast is notoriously difficult to break into. start at trying to think of a good one, Epping or Bennington or,
Stratham, I mean.
Yeah, Stratham. Stratham is a good one. Stratham is very open to local authors.
And what we found is, what was the one we went to? Newbury. We thought we had booked ourselves into Newbury, Massachusetts. All we could do to find the town, never mind the library.
Yeah.
And it was one of the best events we'd had because there was nothing else to do in Newbury, so they came out to our event.
And I think you'll find that once you get into a few libraries, then your book shows up in the system. Like, for example, I can sit down at my, it's called the NUPAC system, which is the New England acronym, I can't remember the rest of the name of, but it's the system where all libraries have, you can go in, and what's your name?
Edie
Holly. So I can punch in Edie Holly, and I can see where all of your books are in the system. So if your books are in 3 or 4 or 5 libraries, even if they're small libraries, then a bigger library like Portsmouth or like Durham or like Dover or something like that will be more inclined to let you into their library. The system stinks, but that's how it works. Yeah.
So that they could check, and the library's names that I gave them that I did really well, I hadn't put it into the system.
They hadn't put it in the system yet.
No,
huh.
So they're behind in a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have about a 2-month turnaround at the Auburn Library, which is a tiny little library.
That's not bad.
Which isn't bad, yeah. I mean, in most of these libraries, if there's not a dedicated circulation manager, it's like the library director who does it, and I mean they're dealing with hundreds. I mean, and they're going to get the new Dan Brown book in the system way before any of our books. So.
What strikes me about this conversation is the incredible difficulty that writers have who don't have a platform in hand selling their wares.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, okay, so you're going to go to, how many cities and towns are there in New Hampshire?
There's 370-something libraries.
So you're going to go to 370.
Just in New Hampshire.
Yeah, and let's just say there's fewer bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say altogether there's 500 basically places you could go, and you could spend the better part of the year going to those 500 places.
Mm-hmm.
And wow, you might actually sell 500 books. You might not, probably not. Half that. So 250. So you spend a year driving to 500 places to sell 250 books, and when did you write again? When you were driving around in your car. I mean, this is sort of the thing, is that when we talk about what traditional publishing does, they don't hand sell much anymore either.
Right.
They used to hand sell a whole bunch. They had guys, salesmen, would drive around and they'd talk to River Run, they'd talk to the Barnes & Noble and blah, blah, blah. And they'd say, hey, what do you got this month? You know, and they said, well, this is, we like this book. This is really good. This is going to move product.
Remember those days? Yeah.
Doesn't happen anymore. But that's, even that broken system is way more efficient than for you to drive around in your car and talk to, you know, and to be a nice person and to connect with a librarian or a bookstore owner, and then how long is that going to take? You know?
And that's one of the things that people ask me about is, well, you know, what is your writing day like?
Right? Yeah.
Because I do a lot of marketing, and I actually, when I talk about my writing day, what I'm talking about is 2 or 3 hours a day of marketing as well as the time writing.
Right.
So it's no longer like you write for, you know, you have an 8-hour writing day, you take a lunch and you have a little coffee.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You write for 2 hours and then you take a break and then you do marketing for 3 hours.
Right.
Or you put together press releases for 3 hours. Or you do research for 3 hours, or, you know, 4 hours. That's what you just got to do.
Right.
And Jim's right. You know, you go into a lot, you get into a conversation with a director and they like you. You can't just be like, well, I got to go. I got
20 minutes. Sorry.
You know? You know? So all of a sudden you spend a half day talking to a bookstore and a librarian, you know?
You have a connection there, but they're only going to buy the book that you write.
Right.
Not the book that you haven't written yet.
And then what if you have that event at the library and like 6 people show up?
Right.
And 0 of them buy a book.
Well, I'm at 0.
Somebody steals a book, you're down one.
Right? Yeah, yeah. That's happened because there are some libraries that won't buy a book, that will say donate a book. I never do because I'm trying to make a living here. But some of them simply won't buy a book. They say, oh yeah, well, you know, sure, we'd love to have one of your books for our shelves.
Yeah, right.
And I said, okay, well, write me a check, and they won't.
So yeah, so that's really discouraging, isn't it? You're not looking all revved up.
Social media.
yeah, social media. Yeah. Just work hard. I mean, it's taken me 6 years to get to the point of where I am, and it's like a rolling point, right? So once you establish a relationship with a library, then you've had that relationship now with that library permanently. Mm-hmm. You know, and then once you have a second one, then you have a bookstore, then you have a, you know, Fabian's that sells books, and then you have the Hooksett toll booth and they sell books, and then, you know, and maybe you only get 6 or 10 or 20 of those a year, but then next year now you have 40, and then the year after that now maybe you have 60. So, it's like pushing a rock uphill, and at some point that rock's gonna go down. On its own, it hasn't for me yet. Though. I'm waiting for that to happen.
Off the tall hill.
I wanted to go back to what, you know, Dan was talking about, you know, with the personal relationships, and you know, if it's at all possible to kind of, you know, haunt some of these, let's say, libraries, you know, before you like make an ask, and you know, just get to know people first. I think that also helps a lot. You know, if there are libraries in your area where it's not terribly inconvenient for you to stop in once in a while and, you know, maybe even do a little work there. The Rollinsford Library is pretty close to where I live. And, you know, for a while I would just, you know, go in there, you know, maybe once a week and, you know, work on my writing or even, you know, work on my day job stuff there because I work from home. And, you know, I just say hello. You know, I'm not a very like outgoing guy necessarily, but you know, I'd say hello to the, you know, people at the desk, and eventually, you know, just sort of through osmosis, you know, got to know the library director, Sarah, and so then, you know, when my book came out, you know, when Mark Huntley came out, you know, she's like, oh, you know, I'd love to buy a copy for this library, and you know, let me know anytime you want to do an event here. And you know, it's it wasn't something where I was like, you know, kind of, you know, manipulating the relationship. It was just like getting known there first as just a person who would stop in and say hi, and sometimes that's all it takes to get things started.
And I think, you know, Jim, who's been in the business for a while, would agree that this is a long game playing here, you know. I mean, a friend of mine used to work at Cambridge Bookstore, this is years and years ago, and as a clerk, and he tells this story about you know, they'd hold these author events, right? And there's this unknown author who had an event there. They scheduled the event for him, and nobody showed up. If you've ever been to Cambridge Bookstore, that's a big space. There's like 40 chairs, and not a single person showed up. So he went around the bookstore grabbing clerks, you know, that were free, just to throw some people in the seats, and he managed to round up 5 people. Yeah. And that author was Dan Brown.
Yep, I've heard this story.
You know, and this was Angels and Demons, right? The one
before the big one.
Yeah, so you know, you never know when you're going to go from here to here.
Yeah.
But you might be going, you know, I look at, because I'm a big chart guy, so I actually track all of my sales. I track every book that I sell, every book that I give away, every book, you know, over the course of the 5 years, I haven't gone like this, but I've gone, you know,
like this.
Mm-hmm. A little bit better every year, a little bit better every month. A few more contacts every year, a few more contacts. And I'll tell you a secret. One of the things that I did early on was I would follow guys like him. And I would follow his Facebook page and see what libraries and what places he was reading and what author fairs he was going to. Right. And then I would make lists. Oh, well, if Jim can go there, maybe I can get in there. Or if Jeff is doing an author fair, maybe I can do that, you know? So, because this one, you know, if Jeff is doing an event at a library that I haven't done an event at, I may not know the librarian, but what I now know is that the library does events.
Yeah, there you go.
Andy knows me.
And
so
I know Jeff.
I could just say, hey, so I can introduce you to the library.
Right, odds are I'll just contact Jeff on Facebook and say, I want to go there.
Yeah.
Who do you know?
But yeah, and that's another thing, too, is it helps to get to know other writers. And, you know, it's a very vibrant community in this state. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are willing to help out, you know, just be a nice person and, you know, say something nice about their books once in a while, and there you go.
Now, we should say this because I'm sure it's been said here before, but if you are looking to connect up with other writers, then Statewide Writers Organization, the New Hampshire Writers Project, is dedicated to putting you in touch with your colleagues and your hopeful colleagues. Mm-hmm. And so there are events going on all the time. There's a giant convocation of all the writers, not all, but many of the writers in the state once a year. And so there's lots of places you can, and there's regional meetings every, the first Monday of every month.
Yep,
where several of the people who are in this room are regulars there. Yeah. And there's one in Portsmouth, there's one in Eppen, there's one in Manchester, there's one in Concord, there's eight of them. And so that's a place to go, is to connect with people and talk about some of these issues.
What is it? What's the name of it?
The New Hampshire Writers Project. Yep. And the first Monday of every month at eight different venues around the state. Groups of writers between, I was just the one in Eppen, it had 10. How many was at Portsmouth last time?
About 30.
Yeah, so yeah. It's all over
Portsmouth
the place.
The one in Manchester has about a dozen. It's at a little coffee shop called The Wren.
Yeah.
And what's the...
It's nhwritersproject.org. Our website is terrible, but we're working on it. So,
wait, Jeff, aren't you on the board?
I'm the vice chair, yeah. Somehow, yeah.
Full disclosure.
And I'm also a client.
Other questions? Yes.
Can you just explain what you mean by platform? I'm kind of lacking with this.
So the question is, what is platform?
You want to take that?
Sure,
You mentioned platform first. You take
that. Really. Sure. Yeah, I mean, platform is just... a fancy name for a group of people who are already like following you, you know, through, let's say through social media or through email or, you know, through public appearances, people who already are aware of you and are interested in you. So if you already have that core group to start with, it's a lot easier for, if you're with a traditional publisher, for them to know that they're going to have a solid base of sales to start out with. And people actually showing up at events if you choose to have them. Mm. And if you're self-publishing, the platform is important because it's, as we've talked about, the distribution question can be kind of difficult. And so if you know that you already have a captive audience, it's a lot easier to start with those people and then have them, you know, squeal in excitement to their friends who then tell their friends and so on and so on.
Like, for example, before you leave tonight, I'm going to ask if you'd be interested in joining my monthly email newsletter.
Hey, me too.
If you say yes.
Wait, I'm going to do two. Yeah.
If you say yes, then you become part of my platform.
Well, the other thing to think about here is that you're sitting there saying, I don't have a platform. Platform? These guys have platforms. I don't have a platform. I'm just me. And here's the thing. You have, not maybe you don't have a platform yet, but you have platform opportunities everywhere in your life.
Yeah.
So say you're a gardener. Maybe you're in the local garden club. Your garden club is your platform. Yeah. And the New Hampshire Gardening Association is your platform. You just have to sort of reach out and make sure that they know that you're one of them and they're among you. They're your friends, the gardeners. You know, you and I believe, are of a certain age. You know, our platform also is senior citizens. You know, maybe people on, Medicare. That's a platform. And so, they're not my people. But yeah, if you have something to say, if what you're writing does touches people in a demographic, in a group of people who are mutually interested in something, that's your platform. Go out and get it. It's much easier than knocking on doors at libraries than it is to have every gardener in the state say, I want to read her gardening book, man. Or I want to read a romance about that she wrote about the gardener who finds true love. You know, that's the sort of thing that you're looking for in your platform. You got to start someplace. So look at all the things you are and all the things that you are that other people are, and then ask yourself, could I make those part of my platform?
Yeah, I feel like when we're talking about a demographic, that's like a market of people that you could then turn into a platform once you get them to care about you.
Right.
Once they start caring about you, that's your platform.
Horse people. Those people are crazy. If you tell them you're a horse person, you're golden.
Yeah.
And incidentally, piggybacking on what Jim just said, every single nursing home and assisted living center and senior care center has a library in that place.
Right.
And they all want books.
Yep.
And some of them will pay for those books. But... there you go. You know, I mean, those are, and corporate libraries. There's tons of corporate libraries out there, too.
Every law firm has a library. That's more than just law books.
The other thing I want to address is for the people who are not here in the room, we've got people now listening to this podcast, and they're writers, and they want to get out and build a platform. But we all go out and do events and look at empty chairs. If you're a writer...
Not tonight, though.
Not tonight.
No, yeah.
No, it's a capacity crowd. Hey, come up there!
But really, writers need to go out and support other writers, yeah, because that way you're supporting yourself.
Right.
I've been a professional musician for 50 years, and it's true for musicians, too. Guys want me to come out and listen to their gig, but they won't come out and listen to me on my gig. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah,
the reason that we're all... you know, working and selling books is because we go, you know, I've been to these guys' events and they, you know, people, they come to our events.
Right.
And that's the way it works. You know, go out and go to your local library and look at the calendar and see when they're having a writer and go to that writer's presentation, even if that writer is writing, you know, something that you don't normally read.
Right.
You're building your platform that way.
Right.
And who knows who you might meet that might be helpful.
Yeah.
And it'll be fun,
too.
Yeah,
and it'll be fun, too.
Yeah, you'll meet some new folks.
Other questions?
Yeah.
Hi. What's your name again?
Dan.
Dan. My name's Colin. I don't write books.
Okay.
But I still write.
Cool.
I'm technically a writer here, but I do...
No, not technically. If you write, you're a writer.
So
you're good.
I write scripts, screenplays,
oh, cool.
That sort of
thing. Okay, yeah.
I'm just wondering how... as far as the whole promotional thing or platform, whatever you want to call it, however it works, is there like a difference or a certain division between like you know authors and screenwriters as far as, you know, selling something or promoting something? Or
The easy answer is no. The more complicated answer is that it's kind of up to you. I've seen authors, I've seen horror writers have a personal personal Facebook page, and then they have their business, writer Facebook page,
yeah,
and I'm a screenwriter, or I'm a horror writer, or I'm a whatever writer, and then it's spread. Now, I combine all of mine. I don't have any, I have no privacy settings on any of my social media. I let anybody in. I am Dan Sesney, writer, and I write a whole bunch of different things. For screenwriting, I don't, maybe Jim could help me more with screenwriting than I, because I've never done that before. But I'm assuming that there are group. I'm assuming that probably New Hampshire Writers Project probably is a as good a place as any for him.
Yeah.
There's probably Facebook pages and groups for screenwriters. I know that there's a fiction writer one. There's a horror. There's a New England horror writer one. There's all of that type of stuff. My bet is, I haven't looked because I don't write screenplays, but my bet is that you could find an equal amount of screenplay platforms as any other platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Are you on Facebook, Twitter? Do you do all that stuff?
Of course.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not on Twitter that much.
The whole Twitter thing, we'll do a whole separate show on Twitter.
Yeah, right.
Because I'm still trying to figure out how to use Twitter.
Yeah.
I made a conscious decision a couple of years ago to turn my social media into my business. Right?
Mm.
It's not personal. It's my business. Even though I post personal things. I post pictures of my daughter, and I write poems and things like that. But it's always sort of with an eye on my readership, my people who are reading my books and reading my fiction. I see no reason why you couldn't do that as a screenwriter, even if you haven't published yet. And I know, I mean, Portsmouth has a ton of local and regional theaters. There's a place in Concord they just opened up called the Hatbox Theater, which is amazing, and they're looking for, in fact, they just put out a submission call, a play call just a few months ago, looking for playwrights to perform there. So, it's called the Hatbox Theater in Concord, New Hampshire. Just Google Hatbox Theater, and it's pretty cool. It's like a little one. The room is maybe
the
size of this room. You know, it seats like 50 people. But, you know, there's all those little local theater outfits that are always looking for stuff.
Colin, have you ever been to one of John Herman's
Of course.
Media
he was there on Herman. He was there last Sunday.
Why didn't I think of that? Yeah, John Herman.
Okay.
No, he's all over that.
I'm definitely
of course
familiar with that.
Yeah, because I know it seems like, I mean, I've only been a couple of times, but it seems like there are a lot of other, like, filmmakers there, too. And, you know, and screenwriters and filmmakers have a huge advantage over, you know, us, because people like to watch stuff more than they like to read stuff. So,
sadly,
you know,
sadly, I'm one of them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then marketing, you have this visual, you know, component built in if you're, you know, if it's something where you have like a visual product. So, mm-hmm. I mean, like, there's a ton of different directions you can go with that.
There's a corporate aspect to screenwriting as well. I mean, there's a lot of companies who are looking for commercials and for PR pieces and things like that that need writers.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, I'd like to know what some of them are.
Stonyfield Yogurt?
What's up?
Stonyfield Yogurt. That's a big one that always has these crazy commercials, and they're always looking for writers to film their stuff. Stonyfield is up in Londonderry, New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
There's a commercial filmmaking enterprise in Portsmouth on Market Street someplace. I forget what those guys' names are, but yeah, there's. I mean, if you know, it's not going to be your short, you know, comic, you know, science fiction thing or whatever you're writing, there'll be commercials. But, yeah. I mean, that's the play, that's the way to get your nose in the door.
And
then we have another question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right, Jeff has something, and then we'll have
a
question.
I just kept thinking back to those billboards, and I just wanted to stand about that.
I know, right? Yeah. I mean, it's stuck with me, too.
So I, you know, and I'm thinking about all these,
what,
like...
what that must have cost.
Well, yeah, I know.
I'm thinking about all these bad reviews this person got, and, you know, it's possible. You know, it's... I'm not saying it's probable, but it's possible that this person was connecting with the wrong readers. You know, if they,
yep.
I mean,
targeted,
sure, yeah, like if you're putting out billboards, like that's not targeted advertising at all.
No.
That's, you know, or marketing. That's
just,
like
you're spraying
whoever drives by, you know, and you know, let's say
truckers.
Yeah, let's say these billboards were for like a, you know, a vampire novel. You know,
they were. There was actually for aliens, like an alien invasion.
Okay. Yeah. Fiction. Well, yeah. So I mean, and that's a great example because, you know, there are some people who love speculative fiction, you know, the
right.
umbrella term for horror, sci-fi, fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some people who hate, you know, hate it with a passion. And if you, you know, if you pick up a book, and particularly if you're not expecting there to be aliens in it, and then there are aliens in it, you know, you might go and give the book a bad review, you know, like, and it just means, like, this was like a case of mismatch between, you know, between writer and reader and, you know, an audience. And,
tone in the first 250 words.
Yeah.
So that's a great way of looking at it. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't go onto a Facebook group about science fiction and start, you know, talking about your horror novels. Right?
Or, you know, your Roman historical.
Yeah, or your historical romance.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It may be a case of lousy targeting. I mean, and what's a more... A less focused marketing campaign than highway billboards.
Right. Skywriting.
I was going to just say, like, jumping out of the skywriting, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So they used to call it spray and pray advertising. like a shotgun, like, you know, just spraying
bullets.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah.
You have another question?
What is a beta reader that you mentioned before?
What is a beta reader?
So I'll start. I have been publishing for 40 years, and I would say of the 130 stories and certainly the 7 novels, almost every one has been read by a writer's workshop. Okay, so I bring my draft in and I show it to other people. Those other people show me their drafts, and then I tell them what I read back to them what I read, they read back to me what they read. So that's sort of the beginning of beta readers. And then when you get to a point where you're actually, you think you might be thinking of submitting, then you want someone to look at your piece for a couple of different things. Once again, to make sure it makes sense, make sure to read it back to you, and so you know that your beta reader understood what you intended. But also that at that point, what's your grammar like? I mean, what's your, you know, continuity? If he was 37 on page 4 and he's 67 on page 9, that's continuity. And sometimes that's because as you were writing, you decide, oh, he has to be older. And then you forgot to go back and change him to 67. So all those things are things that your beta reader, who is going to be your close personal friend, unless you pay him. And even if you pay him, he better be your close personal friend, will help you with. And so then, when you get to that point, then you might actually consider hiring a professional editor. And that's the person who will make sure that all the things that the beta reader, your friend, caught, are you, anything that your friend, the beta reader, didn't catch, your professional editor will catch, better catch.
When I published, when I had the Nepal Chronicles ready to go, which is a memoir about a month and a half trip. I was married in Kathmandu, Nepal, and right. we spent a month in the Himalayas. And I wrote a memoir about that experience. And my beta reader, one of the things that my beta reader came back with was, I don't understand a lot of these terms
yeah.
that I'm using. Because there's a lot of mountaineering terms,
yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
there's a lot of Nepalese words, you know, that I was using. And which made, you know, to me, it's just in my, you know, I was just writing about a call in a mountain. And she was like, what the heck is a call? I don't understand what you're saying here. So I had to go back and I had to make it more accessible. So, and you know, so that's the type of stuff that a beta reader would catch. And then the book went to a professional editor for a line edit.
That's call, like COL?
Yeah, COL, which yeah. is the low point between two peaks.
The saddle.
Yeah, the saddle.
And I'm going to throw this out there. I'm not sure whether it's been experience for you guys as well, but if you, you know, if you have 10 people agree to be beta readers for your book, you're probably going to get right. feedback within the time frame that you need feedback from 3 to 5 of them. And this is also a good rule of thumb in terms of if you're sending out your book to people who you'd like to leave you like an advance review, you know, before you
right.
publish
a
it,
blurb.
Or you know, yeah, like a yeah a blurb or like an Amazon review or something.
Oh,
you know,
I see. Right.
For like launch day.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, blurbs, and blurbs just, you know, being like usually a write-up from another writer that might go on like the back of the book or in, you know, your marketing materials or both.
One other thing I want to throw out is for the people who are not attending events like this, not going to writers' workshops and so forth, get out and do it, because I know these guys because I met them at various writers' events, and we have people coming in that have been at our writers' events and so forth. And so when I finish the next draft of my novel, I'm going to ask these guys to be beta readers. And if they're smart, they'll say no. But at least I know people who I can ask. So get out and meet other authors. Don't just count on your Aunt Matilda to be your beta reader.
Yeah, right.
Find
yeah,
good,
yeah, yeah.
well-read, intelligent mm-hmm. readers to be a beta reader. Chris, you had a question?
Well, yeah, and of course I've had all this time to think of a way to phrase it, and I still don't have a perfect way to phrase it. But it sort of stems from something that Jim said, Jim talked about, but I think any of you guys could talk about it, and that's if you realize that you've got, when you have somebody read it, that you messed up tone-wise, there's something that you haven't gotten there, Here's the actual the impetus for me asking the question.
Sure.
I'm a teacher. Tomorrow I have a student who wrote a very powerful piece of personal memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably like at word 265 cracked a joke. And I said to this writer, I said, you need to get this, you need to let me know that this is a place where I might also hear jokes in addition to all of the heavy material.
Right, yeah.
And I hope that I gave him good advice on how to do that, but when you're revising that first 250 words or that first chapter or whatever, what are your best strategies for taking that stuff that you didn't discover until later and bringing it up front?
Yeah, so sometimes you are writing a story and you discover, as you say, things about it that you didn't know. And so one of the things that a high school student will tell you is, I'm not going to rewrite. I don't want to rewrite. I mean, I wrote it. You know, that was it. That was what I had to say. And so the fact of the matter is that all good writing is rewriting. And so when you discover this magical thing that will take this heavy story and maybe make it more accessible because you have black humor that helps people get through it, then you've got to do rewriting and you've got to go back and honor. You have two choices. Either you rewrite so that there's a foreshadowing of this move that you're going to make later on, or you take the move out. You decide. But you have to rewrite because tonally these two things don't match and it's just going to throw everyone out of you. So one of the things that happens is, and something that's really well written, is you fall into the dream of the story. You're not in a chair anymore. You're not in your room. You're in the story. And when something, the writer makes a misstep, it's like, oh, beep, you know, the phone rings, and you know, and you're out of the dream of the story. And that's this kind of a thing that especially the writer, the reader is going like, well, wait a minute, what? Why did he say that? So that's sort of the thing, you know. But believe me, I have been in a lot of, I used to teach artists in the schools in this, throughout the state. And so I've been in from third grade to high school in maybe 50 different schools in the state. And one thing I know is that kids do not want to rewrite. But the one thing I tell them is, well, you don't have to rewrite, but story's not going to be as good as it can be unless you do. And so, you know, if you're happy with mediocre, then, you know, a good idea that didn't go anywhere, then go ahead, that's it. But this harsh fact of the matter is, rewriting is where the real writing happens, he said.
I know with me, when it comes to tone, one of the things that's really has worked well for me, better now than early on in my career, is that I read it out loud.
Right.
I read the passage out loud. Because I often, my ear can often hear an inappropriate change of tone better than my eyes can read an inappropriate change of tone. And the Nepal Chronicles, you're going to laugh at this. I was writing the Nepal Chronicles when Tron 2 came out. This is a true story.
I'm already laughing.
I swear to God. And the main character
Tron
2 is called Kevin Flynn, right?
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the lines of Kevin Flynn is like, you're messing with my karma or something like that. So there's a passage in one of the chapters where something goes wrong on the trail, and I was feeling this sort of like, you know, sort of Buddhist experience, and then something happened and it was messing with my karma. And I put this line in, like, as Kevin Flynn would say, you know, stop messing with my karma. And I read it now and I just cringe. And it's just this little throwaway line that, and it's just like, it's like the chapter's moving, and then I run the reader right into that wall. You know, I don't know what I was thinking, but it was just a change of tone that I'm so. If it ever goes into a second, a second printing, I'm going to remove that line. But I should have read it out loud. I should have known. Plus, in that particular case, that was very time sensitive.
Nobody remembers that. Just remember the movie. I don't remember anyone's name.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. So now what I do is you know, my wife doesn't actually read any of my work. I read it to her.
Sweet.
And she actually has a really good ear for, you know, that sounds awful. So that she's now my sort of continuity and right. tone manager. Mm-hmm. So ever since I've started doing that, then I've gotten better at it. But yeah, I understand what you're saying. I just read it out loud.
But it's a very subtle thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm.
Sometimes it could be obvious, but sometimes it, you know, it's there and you.
Sometimes it's there to somebody else, and it's not there to you, too.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there's you use a name because you made this great name up, and then it turns out this is a pop star. You didn't know there was a pop
right,
star,
yeah.
And all of a sudden,
yeah.
You know, I just always thought of her when you said that, you know, the vampire. She's not a vampire. She's cute.
Yeah, I was just reading someone's book for a critique, and you know, their book draft, and I don't think they even realize it, but I think their story is supposed to be set in the early 90s, and then there's like the victim of a werewolf or whatever, who who shares the same name as like a swimsuit model from the early 90s. And I'm like,
yeah.
Wait, I'm not sure this guy knows that, you know,
right, that
maybe it was like subconscious. Yeah. And so every time that name comes up in the book, I'm like, wait,
huh?
Oh man. I'm like,
yeah, really?
No, she was living in rural Maine now. No. Yeah. But I guess one thing I want to mention about tone is I think over-editing can destroy tone. Like if you edit something too much and for too long, you may sort of forget the original tone that you intended for the work.
Right.
And I know I've had that happen with work before, and so it's, I don't know, I feel like sometimes you need to be able to step back from it and kind of assess whether it still has the tone that matched your kind of original vision for the book.
Mm-hmm. Have either of you gotten an edit back from an editor or a beta reader that says something like, oh, this doesn't sound good, or this, you know, recast this passage, and you're like, but that's my dream passage. I was in my beautiful dream state when I wrote this. Really, it doesn't work for you? How can that not work?
My workshop is brutal. I mean, so I workshop in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and there's 10 of us, and every one of us has published short stories, novels. Some of us have been award winners. Some people get in the year's best science fiction, and they're brutal. I mean, they just say things like, you know, you can't say that because it isn't, you don't believe it, you know, and the character doesn't believe it, so don't put it in there. Or boy, you did this, you're doing this again, are you, huh? Haven't you read this story? You read that story 3 years ago, and now I'm reading it again? It's the same story. Oh, no. But, I mean, that's what you want. I mean, as hard as it is, when you show your stuff to your beta reader, I always say this to people. Some people say, well, I'd really like you to read my novel.
Right.
And I will say, do you really want to read it? Right? Or do you want me to tell you your novel is fine?
Yeah.
Because
what are you, really
you get, what are you paying for? You know, are you paying for the everything, go ahead, dear, you're fine? Or the, you know, you can't sell this because you really need to start, strip it down to the basics and start over again. And sometimes when, you know, it's really a hard thing to judge because sometimes a kid will send me a story and I really like the kid and I will say, look, do you want the real critique or do you want the namby-pamby critique? Oh, give me the real critique. And I never heard from him again.
Yeah.
You know, this is really promising, kid, but your ending is all wrong. So really, you got to just take the great beginning. The plane took off. It's flying along, but you crashed the landing, so write a different ending. And he doesn't want to hear that. He thinks it's fine, so he doesn't want to rewrite. And so...
Yeah, and just don't get that brutal feedback, like, face-to-face, you know, just have them send it in a message, you know, so that you can then, like, you know, call them whatever you want in the privacy of your own home or for your computer, and then the next day look back at the message and say, all right, this actually does make a lot of sense.
To be fair, like, I'm from the other side, like, I edit a series of books called Murder, Inc.
Yeah.
And Jeff actually appeared in the second one, his short story, which is an awesome short story. And one of the things that this whole editing gig has been cool, and I'm glad that I got it under my belt, but I don't think I'm going to do it again. part of the learning experience for me has been understanding, because I've been on the other side of things. I've gotten rejections, you know, and I've gotten short stories edited to the point of where I'm like, in other words, you want me to rewrite it, is what you're
right,
saying.
Right.
So you learn really fast which writers, and Jeff is one of them, which writers are the professionals.
Right.
You know, and which writers are the are the amateurs.
Right.
Because, you know, I mean, Jeff will tell you, I wrote 4 pages of notes on his story, and he didn't say a word, at least not to my face. You know, and a week later, the story came back, and, you know, it was done. I mean, That's awesome sauce. That's really great stuff when that happens. But it happens.
Right.
So, you know, the funny thing is I think, going back to your original question, I think what all of us here are saying is find other writers. Join some groups.
Yeah.
You know, get some peers to look at your stuff and to communicate. Go to the Portsmouth Book and Bar, right? That's where you guys
meet? That's where we meet.
Yeah.
If you're in Portsmouth, if you're elsewhere, you really go to the Writers Project, because if you live anywhere else, there's something really close to you.
Yeah, man. Find a community that lifts you up.
Right.
You know, and I think, and I found 99.9% of the communities and the writers in this state are amazingly supportive,
right,
and want you to succeed. Nobody wants you to fail.
But everybody I do have to caution too, because I know so many people who make this mistake. Don't get into. I was just reading a book rereading a book that I had read, I don't know, 20 years ago, about poetry, William Packard, and he was talking about workshopping, and he was the editor of the New York Quarterly, and he rejected some of my poetry, and he was really down on writers' workshops. Yeah. And he said too many of them are just patting each other on the back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you have to educate yourself to know whether your writers' workshop is any good. I have a friend who's written 8 books, hasn't published any of them, has been workshopping them for 25 years, and he's perfectly happy with it, but he never got anything published. He said he wanted to get it published, but he never did. Mm. So I just caution people, because I see too many people get into this feel-good situation where everybody pats each other on the back and goes home, which is fine if that's what you want, but if you really want to improve, learn who are the good writers and who are the good critics and who are the people who will tell you what you need to hear, whether you want to hear it or not. It's not easy to do that.
No, you know, writers' workshops come in all flavors, just like self-publishing houses and middle grade, you know, publishing houses. There's a certain benefit to getting together with a bunch of people who aren't going to tear you down, and because you may have imposter syndrome. You've never written before, and you're showing your first effort, and so you don't want to go swimming with the sharks there. You might want a more congratulatory workshop, but that's fine if that's all you want to do. But eventually you will realize that your congratulatory workshop isn't helping you get better. It's just encouraging you to write. Now the next step, I mean, if that's all you want to do is write, then keep encouraging. But if you want to take the next step and see if your writing is worth showing to other readers who aren't in your workshop, then you have to get into the more frank kind of workshop.
Well, I think another potential peril of workshops too, at least in my experience, is sometimes I feel like kind of a pack mentality comes over it, and you know, and it's almost like everyone comes to a consensus of this is what we think is good in a story, and then that kind of standard then becomes like the standard that everyone, you know, either consciously or you know, unconsciously, then kind of like skews their critiques towards, you know, mm-hmm. shaping, and and then it becomes, you know, in a way less useful than if you had approached each of those people individually and, you know, got their kind of feedback without them being like necessarily influenced by other people. Mm-hmm. That's, I don't know, that's my experience anyway.
I was in a writer's group a few years ago, and I've been writing. Like I have a, you know, great American novel that I've been writing for 25 years.
Whoa!
Don't we all? You must have one. Come on.
They didn't publish it.
And it's a historical fiction. It's set in Buffalo at the turn of the century, and it takes place after McKinley's assassination at the Expo.
Oh my God! I have to talk after this.
And at the Buffalo Expo, this is not me writing it. This is fact. McKinley was shot twice, once in his stomach and once in the chest.
Right.
And he survived because these are very small caliber bullets, and he survived for 14 more days, and he eventually died from infection with doctors probing in his wound. Yeah. And after he was shot, his guards, there was a secret service, well, there was the early form of the Secret Service. They were more like, they're early form of the Secret Service. Grabbed the guy and beat him to a pulp right there. And McKinley, actually, as he was lying on the floor bleeding, said, you know, go easy on him, boys, go easy on him. This is fact. This isn't something that I'm making up.
Right.
So in the scene that I wrote for that, one of my writer's group, the people in my writer's group said, no, that's not realistic.
Yeah.
And I said, but it actually, I'm not making it up, that actually happened. And we got into this big long thing where he actually argued that I should change, you know, the actual fact, because it just didn't seem that no reader would believe that he would be able to survive 2 point-blank shots.
Yeah.
And that was the last time I was a member of that group. I quit the next day, and I didn't come back. Yeah. So, you know, it depends on what you're looking for.
Yeah, there could be some opinionated people.
But I actually like critical groups. I like hard criticism. I don't like coffee clubs so much. I like coffee, but
not the club.
I am in a very good group that meets at the Sarah Orange House in South Berwick.
Right.
Oh,
with,
yeah.
Only we only meet once a month, and that's not often enough for me.
Yeah. But do you live in the area?
I live in Dover, the Dover area.
In Dover.
Yeah.
At the last New Hampshire Writers Project Night Out,
for the first time, we've been going to it for a couple of years, and for the first time, somebody actually passed around a sheet of paper and said, if you want to be
in a writer's work?
In a critique group.
Yeah.
They passed around two pieces of paper. One, just if you want to communicate with people in general from this group, but the other was specifically people who wanted to be in a critique group.
Yes.
And so
did you say that?
They're spinning off small groups.
No.
Can be one or two people, three people. So, you know, find. Again, you might want to go to the New Hampshire Writers Project meeting and then see if you can get into a critique group that
right.
way. I'm surprised that they haven't done it before. It's just nobody took the initiative, and our the one that we go to, that nobody took the initiative to do it.
Yeah.
How many people signed up for it this time? Maybe
five or six.
Five or six.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. All it took was having someone who like had some actual marketing know-how come to the meeting
it was Chris. From
yeah. and know how to like. Make things work for people and
exactly.
make them happy. Yeah. So that was helpful.
Other questions? Okay, I think we'll wrap it up. It's been a great session. I want to thank the authors. They did a great job. Thunderous applause for the positive. And we're going to now have some refreshments. I want to thank WSCA Community Radio for the letting us use their facilities here. This is going to be recorded and it will be available through a Mott Publishing website. You can search for Mott Publishing or WPM, Writing Publishing Marketing, on iTunes or on Podomatic and some of the others. Next month, we are going to have Shelby June in the writer's chair. She has written one novel, and now she's written a book of short stories. A little plug here, we're going to be publishing her book of short stories.
Whoa.
So I'm glad to have her. And in the publishing chair, we're going to have a guy who was a student of mine at Berklee College of Music more years ago than I want to talk about, who went on to become a Grammy Award-winning recording engineer. And he has published two technical books about recording.
Huh.
And so he's got a completely different approach to this. He's published through Focus Elsevier Press. And then I kind of miss being in the chair, so I'm going to take Dan's chair next time and talk
there you
about
go.
Marketing.
Oh, yeah.
And in December, because it's so hard to know whether people can show up and when it gets close to the holidays, rather than have our usual panel discussion, we're going to have the first annual WPM holiday hangout.
Yeah, cool.
So we're just going to invite all the writers we know, and once again, we'll provide refreshments. Tonight, we want to thank Philbrick's Fresh Market for contributing some of the food here, the beverages.
Nice.
And we want to thank Marilyn Carter of No Fred Cooking fame
for
preparing, what is it now? The muffins?
Pumpkin, ginger, molasses.
All
right.
Hey.
Yes.
Gluten-free, healthy.
Yum.
Pumpkin, molasses, ginger.
Wow.
And next month, if you come to the meeting, there will be a quiz. We'll want to know what page of No Fred Cooking that recipe is on. But with that, I want to thank everybody and enjoy the food and drink. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
All right, thanks, Steve.
All right.
This was great.